Welcome to the Amazing Relationships Podcast with Kim Wilson, a space designed to help you create amazing relationships with yourself and others. Get ready to experience hope, love, and inspiration. Here's your host, Kim Wilson.
Today we're talking about love and loss. To help me unpack this universal topic, I have a very special guest with me today, Marissa Norman. Marissa was born in Southfield, Michigan, and grew up in Atlanta, Georgia. She graduated from Morris Brown College, magna cum laude, and entered the field of criminal justice and court administration, where she has served professionally for the past 16 years. In 2006, Marissa gave birth to her oldest daughter. In 2012, she married the love of her life. After a series of unfortunate and devastating life-changing events, Marissa and her family took a leap of faith and relocated from Georgia to Virginia to start a new life. Please help me to welcome my amazing guest, Marissa Norman. If I had a little hand clap, it would be going off right now. Well, hello there, Marissa. How are you?
I'm doing well, Kim. How are you?
I'm doing well. Now, I got to let my amazing listeners know that I actually have a little history with Marissa. I love her dearly. She's actually a dear friend of mine. We met in college over 20 yeah. years ago. Uh-oh, are we telling it?
It is quite a story to tell.
But, you know, I'm really okay with dating myself and having someone to know my age because, look, honey, I have this heartbeat, and as far as I know, everything works and nothing hurts.
That's right. And like my dad says always, you're either getting older or you're in the grave. So which one would you prefer?
Look, I'll take older for 1,000, please.
Okay. That's right.
So, yes, you know, I'm so glad that we can have a moment just to laugh at the beginning of all this because we are unpacking it is a universal topic because I don't know anywhere you can go in this world and somebody does not have a story of love and loss. I mean, it's something that, yes, I think all of us experience as human beings. And today we're taking a special look, and we're going to open up that journey with Marissa today because she does have a story to tell. And if it's okay with you, Marissa, I would like to open up that story a little bit about your experience with love and loss. And
absolutely.
So in one of the last – absolutely, okay. And one of the last things that I said in your introduction – you said that after unfortunate and devastating life events, you and your family took a leap of faith and you moved to Virginia. And so I want to start with what prompted that move to Virginia?
Okay. Well, Kim, like you said, I was born in Michigan, raised in Atlanta, where I spent most of my life, actually. I've only been in Virginia 2 years now. Prior to us moving to Virginia, I was blessed to have a daughter, beautiful 11-year-old now, who is my heart, my heartbeat. And then the Lord blessed me to get married in 2012 to my now husband. And we met at the age of 14. So he often says that he was blessed to meet his wife at a very young age, and we laugh about that, and we met at church. And he and I did not have any children together. And so we decided that we were going to go on the journey of trying to have a child together, and that's exactly what we did. And the Lord actually blessed us the very first month of us trying to conceive. We were blessed, which was very shocking to me because I thought that it was going to take, you know, a couple of months, but it didn't. And we became pregnant in February of 2015. And this was a very, very happy time for both of us. And we were excited and we were hopeful and prayerful and asking and praying God to bless us with a healthy child and thanking God that we were going to be having, you know, a child together. And we moved on through life and love. And at that same time, my stepfather, who helped to raise me, was in a very bad car accident. He was in a very bad car accident. And thank God he lived, but he had some severe injuries from this car accident. And so throughout the entire pregnancy, my mother was going back and forth to the hospital and to visit with my stepdad, and I was going back and forth visiting with my stepdad. I was going to all of my doctor's appointments for the pregnancy. Everything looked fine. I never got any bad news regarding that. And I was seeing a perinatologist, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And that's a doctor that you see, you know, when you're over the age of 35 and you're pregnant, they make you see that kind of doctor. And so every time I would go to see this doctor, she always had good news for me, said that the baby was healthy, she was well, moving like she was supposed to. Oh, by the way, we found out that she was a girl. The baby was a girl. We were hoping for a son, but we found out we were having a girl. And so that was fine. And then my stepfather's health continued to deteriorate. He became paralyzed, and he had several surgeries, and he eventually was not able to walk, and he was paralyzed from the waist down. And that was very difficult on the family and very difficult for him, but he was a man of strong faith. And so he just kept looking up and still praising God, and we were just moving forward, making plans, you know, for my stepdad to get the help that he needed as far as home health care and just changing our lifestyle around to accommodate him for when he got out of the hospital. In October, I gave birth to my little angel, Brielle, and she came out healthy. She was 6 pounds and 11 ounces, 21 inches long. She came out with a big smile on her face, and we often laugh about it now because we used to call her grinning face because she was always grinning. She was always grinning and smiling, even at birth. And we have some very nice videos of her smiling and just very calm. She was a very calm child, quiet and calm. And she was just beautiful from day one. And so I was in the hospital for about 3 days, a normal time, you know, when you have a regular vaginal birth. And everything seemed fine. She had little problems with her milk. We had to change her milk a couple of times. I did try to breastfeed a little bit, but it wasn't working for me, so she had to be put on, you know, some regular milk, and meaning, you know, the Similac. I think it was Carnation or Similac, one of those two. And we took her home, and she was doing well. The first night, she slept in a little bassinet next to our bed, because I didn't want her in the big crib. The second night, she wasn't having it, so we did kangaroo care with her and put her down inside of our shirt. I put her down inside of my nightgown so we could have skin-to-skin contact. And she slept just like a baby, literally. So I would say probably maybe that third day I noticed that she was breathing funny. And I said to my husband, I said, you know, the baby is breathing funny. I said, I wonder if she has asthma, because I am asthmatic and I've had asthma since the age of 2. And I do take a controlled inhaler on a daily basis from my asthma. So I said, she probably has inherited some asthma from me. And he said, yeah, probably so, because her chest when she would breathe, you could kind of like see she was struggling to breathe, and you could see the ribs. You could see her ribs as she was trying to breathe, and it was very concerning to me. So we took her to the doctor. Prior to this, when she went to the doctor the first time, the pediatrician, he checked her out. He said everything was fine. He said, oh, she's a beautiful, perfect baby. Perfect baby. And it's so odd that most people that met Brielle for the first time, they always said she was perfect. And that word perfect is always in the back of my mind. Oh, she's a perfect child. She's a perfect little baby. You know, she's pretty. She's beautiful. She's perfect. And so he had just said that to me, and then 3 days later I was bringing her back because I noticed that when she was breathing, that her ribs were contracting. And she also stopped eating, and she was a baby who loved to eat, so I knew something was wrong. So we took her to her pediatrician, the same pediatrician that my 11-year-old daughter was seeing as well. Uh-huh. And so I remember the date just like it was yesterday, because when we got into the room, the nurse examined Brielle first before the doctor came in like they normally do. Mm-hmm. And the nurse said, I will be right back. She said, I'm going to have to go get Dr. Young. And I said, well, isn't he in with another patient? She said, yes, he is, but this is serious. And I knew something then was not right, because I have never known a nurse to stop and go pull the doctor from another patient to come see another patient.
Mm-hmm.
So I was already mentally preparing myself and thinking to myself, what is going on? And my daughter was there. She sat quiet. My husband was there. He sat quiet. And the baby was just laying on the table, you know, with her little diaper on, waiting to be seen. So he came in, and he put the stethoscope on her chest. He listened to her. And for some reason, they were having trouble with a pulse ox. They said she looked fine. She was not turning blue. However, I cannot remember the terminology, but basically her heart rate was off, and he just had a weird look on his face. He had a very odd look on his face, and I said, Dr. Young, what's wrong? He said, Ms. Norman, he said, I'm going to call the ambulance. He said, I want you to we're going to have to get the baby to the emergency room, he said, because I can't help her. And I said, you can't help her? I said, what do you mean? He said, the baby needs to go to the emergency room. And I said, well, don't call the ambulance. I said, I can take her myself. I said, you don't have to call an ambulance. I said, I will take her myself. And I remember she had thrown up on her clothes, and I said, well, I'm going to stop home and get her some dry clothes first. And the nurse looked at me and said, Ms. Norman, you don't have time for that. And I remember thinking to myself, what are they talking as if, you know, as if my child is getting ready to pass away. I don't have time for that. So I said, okay, well, let's just get in the car. So my husband, we drove all the way out to Scottish Rites Children's Hospital in Atlanta.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And as soon as we got to Scottish Rites Children's Hospital, they brought Brielle back immediately. And they said, and I remember the nurse saying, we're going to have to start a trauma room. And I looked at my husband and I said, a trauma room? Why on earth would you be starting a trauma? I said, what is going on? But nobody was really talking to me. They just said, ma'am, we're trying to examine the baby. We'll let you know as soon as we get all the test results back. All of these doctors, they put her on a stretcher and pushed her into this huge room with all these lights, machines, and I saw about 8 to 9 doctors coming in. They all started working on her at the same time. And I remember just standing there like I was in a daze. It was almost like I was watching a movie, like it wasn't me, it wasn't my life. And at that time, my husband had to go sit out with our daughter out in the waiting room area because she was too young to be back there. So by then, I had contacted my mother, who happened to be across the street, close by, visiting my stepdad, who was also in the hospital. So she literally just came right on into the emergency room where we were located. And she was praying the whole time. And the doctor, the emergency room doctor,
began to stick IVs in Brielle, take blood. She was crying. They tried to give her a pacifier. She was a baby that did not like pacifiers, so she politely spit it out every time they put it in her mouth. And I told them, I said, she won't take a pacifier. So they put a little sugar water on it, and she did suck on that. And it calmed her for a few minutes, and then she spit that out. And she, you could tell she was in a lot of pain.
Mm-hmm.
So then the emergency room doctor said, we're getting ready to call the we're getting ready to do some type of echo exam. And please forgive me if I'm not pronouncing these words right, but basically
a scan
of the heart. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
A scan of the heart. They said, we're calling in the cardiologist. They called in the cardiologist, and he did an ultrasound on Brielle's heart. And then after that, he said to me, he said, Mother, he said, what made you bring your child in? I said, well, she was breathing funny. I said, she had only been home 9 days after being born, and I noticed that she was not breathing correctly. I said, and I mentioned it to my husband, and we both thought maybe she just had asthma. And he said, well, has anybody in your house been sick? I said, no. He said, what about her sister, her oldest girl? I said, no, she hasn't been sick. He said, well, it's a good thing you brought her in, he said, because she has a heart condition. And I said, a heart condition? I said, well, what are you talking about? What are you saying? He said, she has a hole in her heart, and she also has a condition called coarctation of the aorta. COA. And he said, and basically, I said, well, what does this mean? He said, basically, the main artery that goes from the main blood vessel that pumps blood to the heart, he said it should be wide enough for the blood to come through. However, hers is thin, and the blood is not able to go through this main blood vessel. And it's causing her little body to try to have to pump blood, and her heart is weak. She's going into heart failure. And I said, heart failure? I said, what are you saying? I mean, he repeated it to me about four different times, because in my mind, I just could not imagine you telling me my 9-day-old child is going into heart failure. He said, well, she's going to have open heart surgery. I said, what? Open heart surgery? He said, yes. He said, she's going to have open heart surgery. He said, because her heart is failing. He said, I'm getting ready to call the chaplain. And when he said that, I lost it. I said, the chaplain? I said, why are you calling the chaplain? Because most of the time when you see the chaplain, that's somebody's getting ready to pass away.
Mm-hmm.
From my knowledge and from my history of seeing the chaplain coming into the room.
Mm-hmm.
Let me go talk to my husband. So they said, go get Dad. So they got him. By this time, my pastor had come up there, and he was sitting with my daughter. And so my mother and myself and my husband was able to be back in the room with the baby. And I was telling my husband about what the doctor said, and he said, what did he say? I said, he said the baby has a heart condition. He said, a what? I said, a heart condition. It was almost like he went deaf. He completely, he said, did you say a heart? I said, a heart condition. And he said, no. I said, that's what he said. He said, well, he must be mistaken. He said, there's no way. I said, well, that's what he's saying. We both were kind of, it was, to say the least, it was just unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
It was unheard of. I mean, I can't even explain it to you in words, you know, for you to have to hear something like that coming from a doctor when this was clearly left field. Nothing like this has ever happened to you before, anybody in your family. And you're being told your 9-day-old child has a heart condition. So they said, we're going to have to take her to Children's Healthcare of Atlanta so she can have open heart surgery. The next thing I know, everything happened so fast. We were in the ambulance. They had hooked Brielle up to all of these different machines so she could be comfortable and so that the oxygen to help her breathe. I was in the back of the ambulance with her. My mother and, Otis actually was following the ambulance, and my mother had Marielle in the car, and she was following. They were following the ambulance as well. So we got to the hospital, and they immediately admitted her. And when we walked in, we saw all these little babies in these separate little rooms. And this was the cardiac intensive care unit floor. So they called it the CICU, cardiac intensive care unit. And you saw all these little babies. I didn't see anybody over the age of 1 year old. All the babies looked like they were between days old to maybe 4, 5, 6 months old.
Mm.
And all of them were hooked up to it. Was a very, very sad sight. And I sat down, and they said, well, do you want to hold her? And I said, yes, I want to hold her. And I held her, and I just was talking to her, and I said, God is with you, and Mommy is here. And you could see she was in a lot of pain, and I kept asking, can she have something to eat? I said, she has not had a bottle, because in my mind she could still eat. And they said, no, ma'am, she's not going to be able to eat until after her open-heart surgery. So 2 days later, she had open-heart surgery, and her doctor was a very, very good surgeon, and he was telling me everything that he was going to try to do. He said, I'm going to widen this, I guess it was the aorta that he was widening, he said, so that more blood can pump through this vessel to get to her heart. That was the plan. The surgery was only supposed to be about 6 hours. The surgery was like 13 hours. The whole time she was in surgery, we sat downstairs in the room where they have parents sit, because they call you ever so often and just give you updates on your loved one, letting you know that the person is doing okay or what's going on, you know, in the surgery room, in the operating room. So we sat there, paced back and forth, cried, prayed, you name it, we did it. My cousin came down, and she sat with us for a while. My mother was there, but, of course, she was taking care of my oldest daughter, and also my stepdad was still in the hospital. So throughout this time, we just waited and prayed and watched. And I would call sometimes and ask, what's taking so long? Finally, that evening, the doctor, because she went into surgery around 7 a.m. in the morning, he finally came out. He said, we're out of surgery. He said, she's very, very weak. He said, the surgery did not go as well as I expected it to. He said, and I was not able to widen that aorta as much as I wanted to. He said, her heart is about the size of a little strawberry. He said, so you can imagine working on a heart that small and tiny. If you can imagine a little strawberry and you're trying to cut into it and basically repair what is broken.
Mm.
And so I said, okay. And he said, well, she's very, very weak. And he said, we're going to have to, you know, be really keep an eye on her. And I said, okay. But I was just thanking God that she was okay. And he said, unfortunately, we're going to have to do another open heart surgery, he said, because I wasn't able to widen that, you know, that stricture as much as I wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at my husband and I said, another surgery? I said, it didn't sit well with me. I felt like she was already so tiny and little. She had already been through so much. So we went on up back into the CICU. He said, the next couple of hours are going to be critical. I said, okay. Now, we were not able to get a room at the Ronald McDonald House because we lived in Georgia. But, however, they did have rooms for parents inside of the hospital. They were little bitty, tiny little box rooms with a little mattress, and you could sleep in there so you could be close to your child, you know, while they were in the hospital. So we were able to get one of those rooms. And we were literally, my mother, my husband, and I were walking to our room to turn in for the night after we visited Brielle, because we couldn't stay long because she was so weak and she was very, very swollen. She actually looked like she was about 2 years old versus 11 days old. So we prayed, we sang songs, softly, we kissed her, and we walked back to our room. As we were walking back to the room, I got a phone call, and it was from the CIC unit. And they said, Ms. Norman, you need to come back up here. The baby has taken a turn for the worse, and you need to get back up here. It's an emergency. All we did was run back up the hallway, literally. And mm-hmm. as we were running back up the hallway, there was on the side of the door, you had to push this button and say who you were and what room your child was in before they would let you back. I pushed the button and I told them what room my baby was in, and the woman opened the door. And I think this part was a mistake, but she pretty much opened the door. And the room that Brielle was in, you could see exactly what was going on. And I promise you, Kim, it was about 15 to 18 doctors in this tiny room all over my child. And I thought I was going to faint. And they didn't mean for that to happen. And so somebody noticed that we were standing there, myself, my mother, and Otis. And the nurse said, the parents are here. Get them down. Get them out of here. Get them out of here. Take them to the consultation room. Close those doors. Get the parents out of here. And somebody came and grabbed us. And to this day, I don't know who it was. It could have been just anybody. That's how out of it I was. I didn't know who the person was and where they were taking me. They took all of us to the consultation room and told us to wait there for the doctor. So we sat in this tiny room and waited. The next thing I know, a doctor comes in and says, parents, we're going to have to put the baby on a machine called ECMO, E-C-M-O. And I used to know what the word, the letter stood for. It's something oxygenation machine, but basically it's a heart-lung bypass machine. It takes the pressure off the heart so that the heart can rest, and it does the job of, I guess, the heart, if I'm not mistaken, but it's called a bypass machine. And so they said, we're going to have to put her on that, and they said, but there is pros and cons to being on this machine. It's going to help her, and they said, because she basically was, you know, going into heart failure once again, that she had not responded well to that surgery. It was a little bit too much for her little body. And they said, but one of the downsides of this is you can lose circulation when you're on this machine. You have to really watch it when the patient is on this machine, making sure no kinks get into this machine and that the person won't lose circulation. So he said, you have to sign off on this paper. And my husband was in shock, so I signed off on it. And my mother was saying, well, wait, well, what? She just kept asking questions, and they said, we're not able to put her on it. She needs to be on this machine, like, right now. We can't do anything until you sign this paperwork. I signed the paperwork, and they put her on the ECMO machine. And they had a nurse in the room with her constantly. They had two nurses in the room. One was watching my child. The other one was in charge of the machine. That's how serious this machine was. You had to actually have an additional healthcare provider in the room just taking care of the machine itself. So she was on this machine, and they said she can't be on it very long. But she was on it for, I would say at least 4 to 5 days. And she appeared to be doing better. However, she did lose circulation. She did lose circulation, and because I noticed it after she was off the machine, I noticed that the tips of her fingers were beginning to get darker. And, you know, and she was like a honey brown complexion baby. So you could see it immediately. The tips of the fingers got darker. I mean, it started to move up the fingers, and the little toes, her little toes became darker. It started off blue, and then it turned, you know, brown, and then dark brown, and then black. And I said, something is happening. They said, well, she's lost circulation, you know, in her fingers and her toes. I said, well, what does this mean? And they said, well, eventually we're going to have to take that dead tissue off. And they said, we're going to have to amputate. I said, amputate? And by then, this circulation had spread all the way up her leg. So not quite to the knee, lower than her knee, but mm-hmm. basically her whole, both of her feet, past her ankles. I would say not quite to the knee, but high, but lower, but higher than the ankle was where the circulation had been lost, and all of that was jet black.
So let me ask, both feet. So when she started to lose circulation in different parts of her body, did part of right. you start to feel like you were losing her slowly? Did
well, you know
did
what,
a sense yeah. of loss?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what, Kim? I still had hope and faith. Mm. And it's so funny that you would ask that question, because when they told me they were going to have to amputate, I immediately called Boston Children's Hospital, because I had heard of a young boy who was able to get two hand transplants at the age of 8 mm. years old.
Mm.
He got the hands of, I guess, another child who had passed away. And I said in the back of my mind, well, I'm going to get my child. My child is going to have some hands and feet, no matter what. And mm. in my limited, naive mind, I said, well, let me get on it right now. And I called Boston Children's Hospital, and they said to me, I told them the situation. They said, well, she wouldn't be eligible for anything like that until she turns 8 years old. And I said, okay. I said, well, I said, I want to go ahead and put her name on the list. I said, because I want her to be able to have that same hand transplant as that young boy.
Mm-hmm.
So then I started looking into prosthetics for her.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the social worker saying something to me. She said, well, she said, Ms. Norman, I think before you start looking at prosthetics, that we need to get the baby out of the, she's still in the critical stages right now. But see, I had already moved past that in my mind. It didn't even, her going away from here didn't even cross my mind. In my mind, she was going to make it. Because mm. I had been praying, I had been fasting, I had been literally begging God, going to the chapel every day, saying, God, save my child. And all of my family members and loved ones were saying, and friends, she's going to be fine, she's going to make it. Everybody was saying these things to me. And even when they weren't, I was just positive and hopeful, and I just knew that she was going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so we saw a lot of counselors during that time. The hospital had a lot of support systems for parents that's going through this. At one point, they said, well, in order for her to go to the step-down unit, we need you all to take a CPR class. We need you to learn how she's supposed to be in her car seat since she has a heart condition. We had to take, like, 3 classes. And I remember saying to my husband, I said, you know, because he was anxious to take the classes. He said, let's go ahead and take the classes so that when they release her, we won't have to, that won't have to be something that we need to do. Because they actually had a checklist of everything you had to do before they would release your child back into your care. And so mm-hmm. he said, let's go ahead and take those classes and get them on out the way. And I said, you know, I said, I'm not in such a hurry to take those classes. So I guess something in me subconsciously knew, but mentally it wasn't, my mind wasn't connecting with my heart at that point. But I just kept saying, I'm not ready to take those classes just yet. He said, well, no, let's just go ahead. I said, okay, well, let's go ahead and take the car seat class. So we took the car seat class. He said, well, let's take the CPR. Well, he kind of talked me into it, and we went on and took the CPR class. And everybody that was in the class, their babies were already in the step-down unit, meaning they were not even in CICU anymore. They had already gotten past that stage. Our child was the only one that was still in the CIC unit.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of stuck with me. I said, I said, all these other parents' children are already in the second phase, getting ready to be released, and our child is still in critical condition. Her doctor, Dr. Cantor, would often come by, and he would check in on her and check her vitals, and he would say, she just needs to get better quicker. That's all he would say. She's doing okay, but she needs to get better quicker. And I would think to myself, well, you know, the healing process takes time. But looking back in retrospect, now I know that the longer you stay in there, more than likely the chances of you coming out is not likely. when I think back on it. The quicker you can get out of CIU and go down to the step-down unit, the more likely the child will make it versus a child being in there for a long period of time. That's not a good sign, and I didn't know that at that time. And so
let me
Oh, go ahead, Kim.
Yeah, so let me jump in there, and I want to ask, because I know you mentioned that I think when she was 9 days old, that's when she went into the hospital. Is that correct? Okay, so when we go from 9 days, how long was she in the hospital from going in at 9 days old and going through all the testing and the surgeries to
Well, she was in the hospital for 55 days.
Okay.
Exactly 55 days.
Mm-hmm.
And she there were days when she would open her eyes and she knew my voice. We did not miss one day of her being in the hospital. Every single day we were right there by her side. My husband would go to work. He would come there after work. I was not working during that time. I was right there with the baby. And I was just marking days off of my calendar, putting an X. She made it another day through. She made it another day through. And she had nurses and doctors who loved her. They would come in and check on her. Even nurses who were not even working on her would check on her. And they called her girlfriend because she had a little personality even at that age. And she would sometimes, if she didn't like something, she'd take and roll her eyes just like my oldest daughter does. So she got that honest, and the nurses would laugh and say, "Did she just roll her eyes at us? We're going to call you girlfriend." So they started calling her girlfriend. And then one nurse called her baby woman because they said, "She acts just like a little old woman, you know." And she was acting and looking like a little woman. And I remember something funny, Kim. They were washing my child's hair every single day. And I said to one of the nurses, very nice nurse, I said, "Excuse me, ma'am." I said, "Now, African-Americans, we don't wash our hair every single day like that." I said, "Please do not wash my child's hair." Because I would come in, my baby's hair would be just dried and sitting up on top of her head and just as tangled. And I would have to come in and put olive oil all over her head and try to revive her curls.
Mm-hmm.
And they would say, "Miss Norman, don't put that stuff on her hair because she's under that lamp and she might get burnt." And I would politely wait until they left, and I would politely put that olive oil on my hands and put that olive oil in my child's head. But my husband, he would tease me, and he would say, "They don't know who they're talking to, do they?" I said, "I guess they don't, because I'm going to put this stuff on my baby's head." And I would put a cute little hair bow on her. I still fixed her up just like as if she were at home, you know what I mean? And thinking back on it, that meant the world to me to still be able to take care of her. Because remember, we could not touch her. We could not hold her. We could touch her, but we couldn't hold her. She was very, very sensitive to touch and things of that nature. And then also she was going through physical therapy during this time. And they were trying to get her legs to straighten out. Because by her going in at 9 days old, she still had her legs kind of like in a fetal position. She hadn't really started stretching her legs out. So they would put a band around her legs to stretch her legs and hold her legs. And she didn't like that, and she figured out a way to take that band. To this day, I don't know how she did that, but every time I would come in, that band would be off. She would have kicked that band off her legs, and she didn't want her legs like that.
Wow.
She wanted her legs up the way she wanted them. You know what I mean? She had a very determined spirit about her. And the days went by, you know, and Thanksgiving came, and she looked very well. She was doing much better. She looked very happy. You could tell she was getting older. She looked peaceful. She appeared to be doing better. And my birthday came on December the 19th, and I remember coming in, and I have a video where I'm singing to her, and my husband is recording, and I said, "Say happy birthday to Mommy." And I have her in the video. And to me, on that day, I was getting a feeling that something was getting ready to happen because she looked very pale. And I said to the nurse on that day, I said, "The baby," I said, "she's looking very pale." I said, she doesn't look like herself. She said, "Well, she's always been that color." I said, "No, ma'am." I said, "I know the color of my child." I said, "And she did not look like this a couple of days ago." she looks very pale. And then they had to put her on another ventilator, a higher power ventilator called the isolator, because the other one was not doing the job. And she was basically in a medical coma. They had to put her in a medical coma so that she would not feel any pain from that machine. And I remember getting in the car with my husband on the 20th of December, and I said to him, I said, I'm not coming back up here. I said, it's over. I said, it's done. I said, it's over. And he looked at me. He said, what are you talking about? I said, I'm not coming back up to this hospital. I said, it's over. He said, you're talking crazy. He said, why would you say something like that? He said, you know, we got to come back to the hospital to visit with our child. I don't know what made me say that, Kim, but the very next day, my child passed away. We were home because that particular day we could not get a room at the hospital, and I got a call around 3 a.m. in the morning, and they said, Ms. Norman, you and your husband need to get up here. The baby is not responding to anything, to any medication. Her white blood cell count was going up. Her pressure was up. They named everything that was going wrong. And I said, okay, we got in the car. My mother was actually out of town. My daughter, she was with our neighbor who lived across the hall, and her daughter, they went to the same school. We got in the car, and we went to the hospital, and the doctor said, we have tried everything, and she is not responding to anything. And I said, well, what have you tried? And he started going down a list of everything that they normally try. She had an arrhythmia, you know, which means her heart. She didn't have a normal heartbeat. She had a pacemaker, an external pacemaker, and we had discussed her having an internal pacemaker. If she came home for the rest of her life, she would have had to have an internal pacemaker for her heart. But they were trying all these different medicines, and they tried this for several hours. And then I said, all the doctors just kept saying, we're doing everything we can. We're doing everything. And one doctor said to me, he was of Indian descent, he said, I said, be honest with me. I said, tell me what's going on. He said, ma'am, at this point, she's just suffering. He said, she's suffering. And I said, that's it. I said, okay. I said, well, you know, I don't want my child to suffer. And he said, well, are you saying you want us to take her off of turn off the, you know, the breathing machine? I said, yes. And my husband, he still didn't want them to turn it off. He said, let them do everything they can. And I said to him, I said, sweetheart, they said they've done everything they can. And you could see it. You could see it in her. You could see it in her. She had gotten more swollen. She was even more pale. You could just see her just getting sicker and sicker. And I said, let me talk to her for a little while. They said, well, ma'am, you know she can't open her eyes. She cannot respond to you. I went over to my child and I whispered in her ear. I said, Mommy loves you. I said, I'm going to see you again. I said, Daddy loves you. I said, Sissy loves you. Grammy loves you. I said, you are going to go to a better place. I said, you're going to have new hands and new feet. I said, you're going to see your great-grandmother. I started telling her about all the people who she was going to see in heaven. I told her, you can run around and play. You don't have to worry anymore. I said, you're going to be fine. I said, you're going to be happy. I started telling her all these things. And when I tell you, she opened her eyes and looked me right in my face. And they had put her in a medical coma, according to them. She opened her eyes when I began to talk to her. I was literally in her ear whispering these things. She opened her eyes and looked at me. I would say she looked at me maybe for about 3 seconds, and then she closed her eyes back again. The Holy Spirit told me to repeat Second Timothy. I'm trying to find it. Second Timothy chapter 4, verse 2. I have fought a good fight. I have finished my course. I have kept the faith. I said that to her 7 times, I just kept saying that to her over and over again. I have fought a good fight. I said, you have fought a good fight, Brielle. You have finished your course. You have kept the faith. Because everybody told me how strong she was. They said she was really fighting for her life. And I think that part of the reason why she fought so hard is because at a point where we were able to let her go. So she held on, and the Lord allowed her to live just long enough for us to accept what was happening, you know, to her. Because she really, honestly speaking, a doctor said to me she should have been born cesarean because me pushing her out was too much on her heart. But she was born vaginally. And then when she was born, her cord was wrapped around her neck. They had to take the cord. So she survived that. And then she survived two open heart surgeries, the loss of circulation in her limbs. She survived that. And she made it all the way through my birthday so that I wouldn't have to have on my mind the rest of my life that my child died on my birthday. However, on the 21st of December 2015, we did sign the paperwork to have, you know, the life support turned off, and we had to sign a do not resuscitate order as well. And we signed that, and they put her in my arms, and the nurse recorded it for us. But prior to that, I asked if they could please baptize her because she had never been baptized. She had been blessed by my mother, but she had not been baptized. And so they brought the chaplain up to baptize her, and the chaplain's name was Emily, and my grandmother's name is Emily. So I felt like that was my grandmother's spirit in that room with us on that day that my child went back to her heavenly father. And Emily, you know, baptized Brielle. Then after that, they placed her in my arms, and they, you know, turned the machine down slowly. And then the nurse, she explained it to us before it happened. She said, you're going to see her heart rate drop. She said, you'll see it on the screen. And sure enough, when they turned it down, her heart rate, it didn't take long at all. As soon as they turned that machine on, so you could see that the machine was the one keeping her alive. It took every bit of not even 10 seconds. I would say probably 6. And
wow.
Then the nurse said to me, her heart has stopped. She gently whispered it, and we just sat there. And Brielle was making some little noises. I guess the body does that, you know, after you have passed on. She was making some little, like, baby noises, like air was coming out of her body. But they were little sweet sounds that I still remember in my mind. And we were able to bathe her and put a fresh pair of, like, a little cute onesie on her because we didn't have any clothes there. So one of the nurses donated some brand-new clothes for us to put on her. And if I had known that that was going to happen, I probably would have brought some clothes from home. And I remember we were listening to Anita Baker song, Ain't No Need to Worry. It'll Be All Over in the Morning.
Mm-hmm.
We just kept listening to that song over and over again, driving to the hospital on that day. And she passed away around a little bit after 7 a.m. on December the 15th. And we were able to hold her the entire time. We bathed her. Now, mind you, I had not held my child for 55 days. I had only held her for 9 days after she was born. So it felt so good just to have her in my arms, even though she was gone and even though she was swollen. It just felt good to hold her. And then her dad held her, and we cried, and we just held her, and I did her hair. And then she had a beautiful nurse, and her nurse that had been her overnight nurse, who loved her dearly, she said, I'm going to walk with you all. We had to walk downstairs to the morgue of the hospital. And it was so odd us getting on that elevator because people were looking at us. You know, our child is going to be with the Lord, and we're holding her, and people were just, it was so eerie. The look, you know, other people were looking so sad for us. You know what I mean? Because they could see, I guess maybe they knew what was going on. I don't know. But you heard people saying our blessings to you, you know, just nice little comforting things like that. And we got off the elevator and we walked down this long hallway, just like in the movies. And we sat in this little room and we waited for our chosen funeral home service to come, you know, to pick her up. And I went to Burlington that day and bought her a beautiful pink dress and some pink tights and shoes. And that's the color I wanted her to be laid to rest in. And then her body was flown to Virginia, where my family's plot is. And 3 weeks prior to that, my stepdad passed. Stepdad passed away. And from his complications. So my mother was devastated by that, and I was devastated. And then 3 weeks later, my daughter passed. So we were devastated by that. And so we just decided we need to leave. It was just too much hurt and pain associated with Georgia. And it wasn't so much the state itself. It was just everything that had happened in the state. So we just, my husband came up here first, got a job right away. Within a matter of a couple of days, to be honest, we got a job right away. We were able to come right up and purchase our home. I got a job about a month later, and everything just fell into place. Everything just fell into place, and that's how we ended up in Virginia, and that's where we've been ever since.
Thank you so much for sharing that powerful story. And I just want to get in there just a little bit because I heard a lot of powerful things as you were talking. So during the whole process of your daughter being in the hospital, and so and I just love the perspective that you took, because me hearing the story on this side, I asked the question, well, did you feel like you were losing? You started to lose slowly. You're like, no, because you were hopeful. And that's love. And because what I heard just throughout the story was being surrounded by a support system. And that support system is love. I heard your parents. I heard your husband. I heard friends. I heard family. I heard counselors. I heard nurses. I heard the doctors. Right. And that's powerful. And so, and just the amount of trauma and pain that was going on, because not only were you dealing with the experience of your daughter, then there was the whole experience of your stepfather, and of course what touches him touches your mother. That impacts the whole family. So you all were dealing with a lot of trauma and pain. In your mind, now that you look back on it, just in retrospect, how do you think you got through it? What inspired you the most or motivated you the most just to take an extra step every day?
Well, Kim, that's a good question. And to be honest with you, I'm still trying to get through it. You know, losing a child is something that you never get over. It's something that you learn to live with. Mm-hmm. And every day I pray and ask God to bless me to live on. And part of the reason why, what helped me to get through it, is the fact that I know that she was such a survivor and a strong, she had a strong spirit herself, even though she was a baby. And the look of determination in her eyes, when she had her eyes open, letting me know, Mommy, I'm here. While I'm here, I'm here. She was all there. She would listen to me. She would smile. She heard my voice. She enjoyed me reading storybooks to her, singing church songs to her when she was living. And I know that she would want me to go on. I also have my 11-year-old daughter, who was actually the one that kind of pulled me up out of my depression, because I went through a horrible stage of anxiety, panic, and depression. And she was the one, when I was laying in the bed one day, she said to me, Mommy, you still have me. You still have me, Mommy. And it made me realize, yes, I still have you, and I still got to keep moving forward because I still got to raise you. You know, wow. Because there was a time, Kim, I'm going to be honest with you. I didn't want to make it. I just wanted to just go away from here. That thing really devastated me, and I was severely depressed. I'm talking about a depression that I can't even speak on. It was the type of depression that you don't even, you know, it's just very debilitating, to say the least. But what Oh, go ahead, Kim.
I just wanted to go inside of that depression and anxiety a little bit, what that felt like, what that looked like. I heard laying in the bed, and I heard, you know, not wanting to be here. Did you have an appetite? Were you eating? I mean, let me just tell you all, Marissa and I, you know, as awful as this may sound, we connected through food because there are certain mm-hmm. foods that we love eating together, and we felt joy in it. We would laugh about it. So what about all of that? Because Marissa, she's slim and trim, but Marissa can put it away. Let me just tell you. It's true. So Marissa,
right, Kim, you know, we love to eat.
Yes. I mean, so what about that part? Did you lose your appetite for food or any of that?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I lost a lot of weight during that time. I would not eat anything. I did drink some water because my throat was constantly dry. But I was not eating. I was not eating at all.
Were you leaving the house?
I was not leaving the house. My mom was practically taking care of my daughter at that time. She was 9 years old. And she was making sure she got on the school bus. And, you know, thinking back on it, some days I didn't even know where my oldest daughter was. Next day I would say, well, where is my child? And the mother would say, well, she spent the night with your aunt, or she went over to, you know, she spent a night with our neighbor whose daughter is the same age as her, and they went to the same school. So it was that bad. I had lost track of time and circumstance, everything. I wasn't going to church. I was not even getting up to shower myself. And then I started having really, really bad headaches, and come to find out I had postpartum preeclampsia. Normally people have that during their pregnancy. I had it afterwards, so I was put in the hospital. And I was put on some very, very high blood pressure medication. And when I got out of the hospital, it was too much medicine for me. And I would be falling out, passing out. I couldn't walk. I couldn't bathe myself. My husband had to give me a bath. I couldn't sit down and use the restroom. It was horrible. I just went through a lot. I went through a lot. And like I said, my daughter was the one that said, she was standing over me saying something to me about school, and I was just out of it. And she said, what about me, Mommy? You still have me. You still have me, Mommy. What about me? And I said, you're right. And I snapped out of it. I had to push myself and pull myself and throw myself on the ground and beat myself up, but I got myself up out of that bed. And each day it got a little bit better with prayer, and I still was very – I'm not gonna lie to you, Kim. I was very angry with God. I said, "Why me? Why my child? You know, you could have done anything else to me. Why did you allow this to happen?" So many of those other babies had heart conditions, and they were allowed to go home. How come my child couldn't have been healed? And one day, I said to my mother, "I said I prayed and asked God to heal my child." I said, and He didn't answer my prayer. And my mother said to me, "But He did answer your prayer." She said, "He did." She said, "She is healed. She's just healed in a different realm. But she's been healed. She's no longer in pain." You know what I mean? And she said, imagine a life with no hands and no feet. You know, she said, you think you're sad, not being able to do certain things. She said, the Lord did what was best, because it says in His word, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And so I would constantly deal with my questions of why me? Why did this happen to me? And why did this happen to her? Why did this happen to our family? And I still get very teary-eyed when I see a child that would have been around her age, because she would have been 2 years old at this point. She would be three in October. And sometimes when I'm in stores and I see kids around that age, it makes me feel, I get a sadness, but then I just remember my child is in a better place and I will see her again. I know I will see her again.
So do you still feel angry at God sometimes?
Yes, I do. That's the truth. Yes, I do. Yeah. I just had an episode a couple of weeks ago.
You know, I heard three. I heard you say three powerful things as it relates to just taking a step forward and getting to that space of acceptance. Well, first, let me ask: do you feel like you are sitting in that space of acceptance, accepting the experience and everything that has happened? Do you feel like you are sitting in that space?
Yes, I feel like I'm sitting in that space, Kim. Because what choice do I have? You know what I mean? I have accepted it. I really don't have a choice. So I've accepted it so that I can continue to move forward in my life, and so that I won't be stuck in a deep, dark place. But for my own health's sake, you know what I mean? For my own mental and physical health sake, I had to accept it.
So I want to go back to those three powerful things that I heard you say as it relates to moving forward. One of the things that I heard repeatedly as you told your story was prayer. It seemed like you used the power of prayer to kind of move you forward. So prayer may look different for many people. Some people may use their meditation as prayer, but just that pausing and focusing on this moment of healing and the power of words and thoughts just to get to that space to help you heal.
Right.
The other thing, the most powerful thing, was action. When your daughter stood over you and said, "Mommy, you still have me. What about me?" And you said, "I did what I had to do to get myself out of the bed, to push and pull." So moving forward is connected to an action. It's one thing to think it, and it's another thing to do it. So you had to just walk in the doing. And thirdly, what I heard you say was gratitude. Not only did you look at your daughter and be thankful for her, but you found a way to be thankful for having her for 55 days. Being thankful, that's sitting in the space of gratitude. And when we begin to sit in this space of gratitude, it produces a positive feeling. And it's very healing and therapeutic and cathartic and all of those things. So it is my immediate wish for all of the mothers, the fathers, the sisters, the brothers, anybody who has ever lost anybody near and dear to them, to connect with your story, to hear your story, and to hear how you took one step forward after the other. Because where you are today, you are not always in this place. Like you said, there were some days you just did not want to be here. And to be honest, to say, hey, look, I still have my days, but you're still moving.
Yeah.
You're still moving.
That's right, yeah.
Marissa, thank you so much for coming on to this podcast and sharing your story. Of course, my prayers will continue to be with you. Thank you for allowing me and the world to step inside of this space and your journey with you. Is there anything else you want to offer or say to those who are listening before we close?
Yes, I would like to say, like you said, to any of the mothers or just anyone in general who has lost someone that is very close and special to you, look for your loved ones in other ways. I have found that to be very true. When you hear people say that your loved ones will come to you through different things like birds, little animals, other children, other people, other signs that they are still with you, because they certainly are. That body, that flesh, turns back into the dirt, but that soul and that spirit still lives on. And that spirit and that soul is still surrounding you. They still love you. They still want the best for you. So look for your loved ones in other ways, and you will see it. You will see it. And I have seen it quite often with my daughter. I have had birds come and sit on my car for days. I have had butterflies come and gently sit on my shoulder. I have met children in the store. I met a little girl recently, and I asked her what her name was, and she said Brielle. She was about 3 years old, and that was right around my child's death anniversary when that happened. If you pray and ask God to, I often say, God, give the baby a kiss for me. Let her know I love her. And then I will feel a sense of just a strong feeling of love, or I'll have a dream about her, or I will feel a presence surrounding me. Look for your loved ones in other ways, and they will come to you. They will come to you. And the last thing I want to say is know that God has a purpose for your life, and we don't understand. His ways are not our ways. His thoughts are past our thoughts. But you will understand it better by and by, even if it means when we all pass away. That's just my belief, that you'll understand why these things have taken place. But if you just know that, you will begin to feel better with time. Give yourself time, and don't put a time frame on your grief. If you need to cry for a whole 5 years, then do that. But just keep slowly but surely moving forward, because that's what they would want you to do.
Yes. Well, thank you. What I would like to do is close out this podcast, just pausing for a second to honor the memory, the spirit of Brielle Norman. Thank you. Marissa, you did it. And I love you.
Thank you for listening to the Amazing Relationships Podcast with Kim Wilson. Want more? Visit kwspeaks.com. That's kwspeaks.com for the latest inspirational blogs.